This young artist, very talented young man, although that's irrelevant really, who was arrested for supposedly having a prop gun on a video. What does that mean for freedom of speech for, you know, inside this country whatsoever? That you look at YouTube and you can see hundreds and hundreds of videos of white people shooting not fake guns but real AK-47s and big you know, machine gun kind of things, etc. And you see this going on. They're not arrested. This is clearly targeting the democratic rights of the African community, and it's like ratcheting it up even another level so that Africans would not have freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And I just want to call on all white people and everybody who supports democratic rights and the ability of the African community to, you know, to prosper and to live outside without being targeted by this vicious counterinsurgency, to take up this campaign, get this out everywhere, because this must be overturned.
Uhuru. And today, if you're in St. Petersburg, there's a meeting at the Uhuru House, 1245 18th Avenue South, at 4 p.m., where you can learn more about this case and how you can get involved. And tomorrow at 1:30 is Fred Rio's court hearing, Pinellas County Jail, 49th Street in Clearwater, Florida. So we call on people to come out and support Fred Rio there. So that's the end of our program. We appreciate everyone for listening. Thank you, Chairwoman Penny Hess, for participating in this program today.
Uhuru.
Uhuru.
We should have a nice show for you today. And this is a African Liberation Month, and African Liberation Month is February, and it really began in 1926 with Carter G. Woodson. He started Negro History Week. And in 1926, if we go back to 1926 and we look at the state of the world, the state of the black world, at that point we only had three countries with any semblance of so-called independence. We had Haiti, of course, which freed itself in 1804. We had Liberia, really a neo-colonial, a neo-colony of the United States, and we had Ethiopia, which was only colonized for a brief moment by the Italians, but the rest of the black world at that time was, we were recovering from the African slave trade, and we were recovering from colonization. Africans had been taken out of the continent, spread all over the Western Hemisphere from Brazil to Brixton, and the French, the English, the Germans, the Spanish, the Dutch went to town on the African continent and colonized the whole African continent and sent many of us to places like Canada, places like the United States, Cuba, Jamaica, Brazil, Trinidad and Tobago. Some of us were taken to Antigua. And many of us ended up in Halifax, Nova Scotia, so on and so forth, and we are here today. And we're waiting to hear from Aisha Khalid from the Khalil, pardon me, from Sweet Honey in the Rock. And you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and I'm speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. And this is, most people refer to it as Black History Month. And the Sweet Honey in the Rock is a group that was formed by a number of people, including Bernice Regan Johnson. She's the founder of Sweet Honey and the Rock, and she is from Georgia. I believe she may be from Albany, Georgia. And Sweet Honey and the Rock is a group of black women from all over the place. And this is, we are definitely waiting for a call from her. And is it possible to put on another piece of music? You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio.
I wanted more to pay, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home asbestosis and silicosis, prolonged long black lung disease. And the radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones.
Radio, and my show is called Diasporic Music, and joining me on the line is Aisha Cahill. From Sweet Honey and the Rock. How are you doing, my good friend?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful, and I really enjoyed your show that you did in Toronto, Canada. And where are you now in terms of touring?
Right now I'm at home.
What is the next show?
The next show is the 8th of March.
Oh, okay. So you have some time off. Beautiful. I understand you're from Buffalo, New York, and I have some ties to Buffalo, New York. I used to write regularly for the Buffalo Challenger, so I assume you know Sister Barbara Alnisa, Alnisa Banks from the Buffalo Challenger.
No, actually I left Buffalo when I left to go to college, and I haven't been back since.
Oh, okay. But let's talk about the new CD that you guys have and the tour that you're taking, that you're embarking upon now.
Okay.
No, I wanted you to talk about the new CD. The new CD. I saw that you have. I got a poster saying that you're going to be paying tribute to Odetta, Abby Lincoln, and a lot of the great women that have contributed.
That's coming out. It hasn't been released yet.
Yeah.
So we're not actually touring with that project at this time. We're the latest CD to be put out was a single called "Are We a Nation."
Yeah, I have that.
The Arizona situation.
Right. In terms of that Arizona situation, you guys, there's a lot of hysteria around immigration, and that CD basically takes the position that the United States government is on the wrong side of history on that particular question. Could you talk about who wrote that song and how it came about?
Well, actually, we all wrote the song together. It was the second song that we've written as a group. And we felt that we wanted to have some response to the immigration situation in Arizona. And so it's a great song. It's been out now for about 2 years. It kind of brings to light, some of the feelings that we have, our gut feelings and gut reactions about that, but it also says that we should always be willing to listen to both sides. Because I think that situation is there. It's such a tenuous one. And so many people are so filled with so much emotion that it's difficult for people to listen to both sides of the, controversy.
Right.
So, kind of put our ideas out there, but also say that in order for this country to continue to be great, we also have to listen to and respect both sides of the story.
Now, Sweet Honey and the Rock, your group, you did a beautiful, first of all, I wanted to let everybody know that you did a beautiful rendition of the Redemption song, and, that is, I guess, brought the group and yourself rave reviews. How did you? We're going to do a tribute to we're going to interview a young man by the name of Clive Walker, on today's show, who wrote a beautiful book about Bob Marley. But what inspired you to do that song, and how did you go about interpreting that song the way you interpreted?
Well, actually, it's grown. I arranged this song for Sweet Honey quite some time ago. We've been doing it for a while.
Right.
And actually recorded. There's a recorded version. I forget what CD it's not actually on. But it's been evolving since we've been performing it. So, it's just, continue to expand and branch out and, find more ways to do different things with it and to do improvisation on it, and it's just fun. I really enjoy doing that and getting the audience involved. It's a great time.
Well, you used to come to, you hadn't been to Toronto in many years. I saw the group at one time at Convocation Hall, and I was with a group called the Biko Rodney Malcolm Coalition, and we presented Sweet Honey and the Rock with an award for refusing to perform in South Africa when there was an apartheid situation. Many people argue that, there's still problems there. But at that time, there was a cultural boycott, and Sweet Honey was one of the groups that refused to perform in South Africa. How long had it been since you had, between your stops in Toronto, and why hadn't you guys been coming to Toronto for that period of time?
Actually, I don't know. I guess it was one booked up there. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to answer that, but I do remember back when we actually had an opportunity to go to South Africa because we were doing a tour of East Africa. We went all over Kenya to even went to Namibia, and we had to make a transfer in the South African airport.
Right.
We didn't actually go into South Africa. We had to make a transfer from Namibia to go to Swaziland. So I remember us going through that airport, and I'll never forget the feeling of hostility that I felt from the whites who were working there. It was all whites working there back in that time, but I'll never forget that feeling. So since then, we have a lot to celebrate. South Africa's coming up. I do remember that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really glad that we put our foot down and refused to go there at that time.
Well, we gave this award out because I think it was Roberta Flack inspired us, because I think she turned down $2.5 million to perform there, and we gave, there was another group out of Halifax, Nova Scotia, called For the Moment. We gave them awards, Holly Near, Gil Scott-Heron, Linton Kwesi Johnson, Bobby Womack, Eddie Kendricks, and David Ruffin. We had quite a few people that we used to do that to when they came to town. We would go on stage and present them with the Mighty Sparrow, present them with this award, and, I remember doing that, giving it to the Mighty Sparrow, and some of my Calypso brothers and sisters, they wanted to hear the music, but Sparrow kind of cooled them out when he talked about South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a song, you guys do some songs in Yoruba. What inspired that? Is that a collective effort, or is there one person in the group that's more into the Yoruba culture than the others?
No, we don't really have any songs in Yoruba that we do.
The Yoruba chant that you did? I think there was
no,
a Yoruba chant.
For a while, from Senegal, the Mali, the Denko.
Well, that's Wolof, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Wolof. But I thought you did something in Yoruba as well. Maybe I'm wrong, but I know you do a number of African languages.
Not too many, really. No, we don't. We do have that one chant that is in Wolof, and I think Aiza might have led a chant that comes from the rainforest in Africa.
That would be Congo, Central Africa, or the Congo. Yeah, rainforest. Okay,
mm-hmm,
you did that
mm-hmm.
here in Toronto.
I don't remember.
Oh.
But we actually don't have a lot of songs that we actually do in different African dialects. But that one song that Natanji Bolade Castell led, the Denko, is in the Wolof language.
Right. You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Richmond. I'm speaking with Aisha Khalil. And could you talk about, you say you're going to start back in March. Where will you be touring next?
Actually, we have our performances in North Carolina, in Durham, and someplace else I can't quite remember.
Now, when you came to Toronto, the audience was predominantly of European background, but I noticed that there was absolutely no problem in terms of you getting to the audience, and I speak to a lot of people about, you know, the impact of black music, you know, be it blues to reggae to calypso, and it seems to me that since the Fifth Jubilee Singers went to Europe, I guess that was in 1873, black music has always been received by the masses of Europeans, and it's always been a problem with, say, the media, and they split music up. But how do you feel that you were treated in Toronto the last time in terms of the way you were received? I was really blown away. It looked like you guys, it was like a family night that night.
Oh, it was a great feeling. Yeah, it was really great to be back in Toronto. And our audiences have a total range. We do performances for young people as well, so we have that audience from old, very young people to very old people from all different economic backgrounds to all different racial makeups. So sometimes it's hard to really tell actually who's out and who's there because, you know, you can't really see from the stage
right.
Because it's dark. So, but you're telling me that it's more Caucasian people. A lot of places will find that, but some places they go, say if we go to Atlanta or maybe when we're going down to North Carolina, we'll find more black people.
Right.
To come out to the show.
Now, recently we lost, the world lost Etta James, Don Cornelius, and Whitney Houston. Could I get we're winding down. Could I get your thoughts on Etta James, Don Cornelius, and Whitney Houston?
Oh, just very sad to see them go. But death is a part of life, and we just appreciate all the beautiful legacy that they left for us to share, to listen to, and be inspired with. Very sorry that, especially Whitney and Don, may have had the problems that they had, but it's part of life. We all have to live our lives and learn the lessons that we can on this plane and then move on when it's time for us to move on and give each day the best that we have to give at each moment. Try to stay in a thoughtful existence at each moment.
Did you ever hear the song that Whitney Houston recorded with Archie Shepp, Memories? It was part of the group Material, and this was done in 1982, before she signed with Arista. Had you ever heard that?
No, I don't think I heard that.
It's on YouTube, but it's under Material. It's Archie's playing saxophone, and Whitney. It's called Memories. It's a very beautiful piece.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you definitely should check that out. But in terms of who influenced you as a vocalist when you were coming up?
Well, I was I came up singing in the church, and then later became a part of a choir in my high school, which was a semi-professional choir, and had all different branches of the choir, the a cappella, small unit. We did a lot of European classical music, and I really got a firm foundation with the a cappella music. And then I began to branch out into jazz and loving the music of Leon Thomas, Bill Sanders, John Coltrane, Betty Carter. I love Roberta Flack, the vocalist. There's so many artists that have influenced me along the road. Even now, I continue to be astonished and influenced by all the talent that's out there today, just to be enjoyed. And I do enjoy it. I love Brazilian music. I love jazz. I love the softer stuff. I love reggae. I guess one of my favorite music, actually. I love African music. I love it all, and I'm influenced by it all, informed by all of it.
You mentioned Betty Carter. Now, Betty Carter is one of the most underrated singers, I think, that the world has ever produced. I had an honor of meeting and seeing her and interviewing her. She was not an easy sister. She was pretty hard on a lot of. She talked about she respected people that knew their craft as opposed to people that were faking the funk. She was really critical of certain people that she felt didn't really practice their instrument or their art. You know, that were just jumping up and doing their thing. Did you ever see her live?
No, I never had a chance to see her live.
Yeah, she was a great, great.
I loved it. Yeah, I do love. I've always loved her music.
In terms of the, did you go to? You went to a Baptist church, I presume.
Actually, went to more of a Pentecostal type of church.
Oh, okay, Pentecostal. That's more. I'm not putting shades and things, but the Pentecostal is very close to the to the African way of worship. Baptist is, but I mean Pentecostal is that's the same church that I think Peter Tosh and Marvin Gaye came out of the Pentecostal church, right? It's very African oriented, wouldn't you say?
I never thought of it like that, but now that I think about it.
The Pentecostal church, I mean, they it's more freer than
Yeah, well, it was free. You know, people could just start singing, lining out hymns, that kind of thing, and
right.
You know, we had a choir, and you know, sometimes drums, you know.
You could play instruments in the Pentecostal church as well, right? Drums and
definitely.
Mm-hmm. bass players. Right.
We never had a bass player, but we definitely had a drummer and a piano.
Right. Well, let me, is there anything else you would like to add? We have 2 minutes left, and I want to, you said that you wanted to be off the phone by a certain time, so anything else you wanted to add? Your website, I guess you want people to go to your website and sign up to get your updates, right?
Sure, that would be great. They can go to sweethoney. And the rock.org.
.org.
Mm-hmm.
And could you give us a preview? Have you recorded this? Are you were given our cards when I saw you in Toronto, talking about a new CD with songs from Abby Lincoln, Odetta, and a few other sisters.
Yeah, we recorded that. We did a tribute show for Nina Simone, Odetta, and Miriam Makeba, and Abby Lincoln as well.
Right.
At the Center back in last spring. And we had two nights there, so we recorded both nights, and we produced a record from those nights, which has still not been released yet. But we're looking forward to having it released and beginning touring with that. We've done a few more shows. We actually performed in December, the same tribute show at the Blue Note in New York, and at Yoshi's in San Francisco. So we've had three opportunities to perform with that show. We actually did that show and do that with musicians. So it's very difficult. We have a trio. So it's a lot of fun, you know, get chances, you know, take our individual solos, plus sing with the group, plus have the a cappella part, plus perform with the band as well. So it's a lot of fun.
All right. We have been speaking with Aisha Khalil.
Khalil.
Pardon?
Yes.
And Aisha is one of Prophet Muhammad's, that was one of Prophet Muhammad's wife's names, right?
Yes.
And Stevie Wonder named his daughter Aisha, I believe. So, yeah, so you picked a good name. Beautiful name.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we would. I'll look forward to checking out the new CD, and take care of yourself.
Okay, let me just say that I also have my own CD that I've released.
Please plug it.
It's called Journey to My Car.
And how can people get that through the Sweet Honey's website?
Well, you can go to my website, AishaKhalil.com. You can go get it, and you can hear parts of it. You can get it on iTunes and CD Baby. So you can check it out. A CD that I put together from my own compositions and arrangements. And it's not a cappella. There's a few a cappella parts, but it's not all a cappella.
All right. So I thank you, and I look forward to seeing you the next time I'm in the city where you are, next time you come across the border and come into the great white north again.
Okay, then I'll stay warm up there, okay?
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
And we are getting ready to pay tribute to Whitney Houston. And we're going to start this set off with the music of G.C. Cameron, formerly of the Spinners and formerly of the Temptations. And this is the original rendition of It's So Hard to Say Goodbye to Yesterday.
Don't know where this road is It's so hard to say goodbye to yesterday. So hard to say goodbye to yesterday.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. This is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, and we have been listening to the music of G.C. Cameron, and G.C. Cameron was a former lead vocalist with both the Spinners and the Temptations, and that was taken from a song from a film called Coolie High, and that was the original rendition of How Do I Say Goodbye to Yesterday. And G.C. Cameron put that up on YouTube recently, and he put it up as a tribute to Etta James, Don Cornelius, and Whitney Houston. And on this segment of Diasporic Music, we're going to be paying tribute to Whitney. Now, this is a song that was recorded by Whitney Houston in 1982 with a group called Material, and she is assisted on this particular track with by the man who gave me the name for my show, Diasporic Music, Archie Shepp. This was recorded in 1982, and Whitney really began to make noise around 1986. But this is Whitney Houston and Archie Shepp doing a piece called Memories, and it's under a group called Material. And let's listen to Whitney Houston with a little assistance from Archie Shepp, and then we're going to hear Whitney and Teddy.
Mm-hmm. hold you and touch you and make you my woman. I'll give you my love with sweet surrender. Tonight our hearts will beat as one, and I will hold you, touch you, and make you my woman tonight.
There's something in your eyes I see, a pure and simple honesty.
Hold you.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. This is Uhuru Radio, and this the show is Diasporic Music. My name is Norman Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. We are paying tribute to Whitney Houston, Whitney Elizabeth Houston, who passed away recently, and we are listening to some of her music. That we heard a track with her and Theodore Pendergrass, and we also heard her with Archie Shepp. Archie Shepp was on tenor saxophone. Now, African music, black music, has influenced the whole world, beginning with the Fis Jubilee Singers in 1873. The Fis Jubilee Singers went to Europe in 1873. They went all over to Europe, even to Eastern Europe, Russia. It was before the Soviet Union. And Europe then was not like it is now. There were not that many African people, or it was mostly Europeans, Caucasians in Europe at that time. Fis Jubilee, and the Fis Jubilee Singers knocked the socks off of the European audience. Since that time, you took the jazz musicians, they did the same thing, the blues musicians, and of course Calypso. When Calypso came out, Harry Belafonte's album Calypso was the biggest, well, the first million seller that was an first. He had the first million selling album, and of course we had R&B and reggae swept the world, and Fela, the music of Fela, swept the world. And African music or black music has been imitated and duplicated by many people. Right now, we're going to hear a young man from Taiwan do his rendition of I'll Always Love You, Whitney Houston song, which I guess it's really a Dolly Parton song. But this young man out of Taiwan, which is the same place that produced Jeremy Lin, he's a Taiwanese, and Taiwan is a breakaway state from the People's Republic of China. It used to be called Formosa, but I'm not going to politicize the situation except to say that this young man can chirp, and I think we're going to give him a James Brown pass, and we're going to listen to a young man from Taiwan sang Whitney Houston's I'll Always Love You.
I would only be in your way. But I know I'll think of you every step of the way. And I will always love you.
City. Tonight, from Radio City Music Hall, the recording industry presents its highest accolade to artists and musicians for outstanding achievement on Music's Night of Nights.
I would only be in your way, so I'll go, but I know I'll think of you every step of the way.
listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. And I would like to send a shout-out to Kenny Hamilton, who's listening to us in Montreal, and Keisha Bolton, who is teching the show today, would also like to send a shout-out to Kenny Hamilton. And I'm joined on the line. On the line with me is Clive Walker, who is, we're speaking to him. He's somewhere in Ontario. And Clive Walker is the author of a great book on Bob Marley called Reggae Reasonings. Give us the correct title of your book.
Yeah, the book is called Dubwise, Reasoning from the Reggae Underground. There's a chapter in the book on Bob Marley, but there's a number of other chapters that deal with the broad expanse of Jamaican popular music, from jazz to ska to rocksteady to roots reggae, all the way to dancehall and hip-hop.
Well, let us deal with Bob Marley, the singer, Bob Marley, the instrumentalist, and Bob Marley, the songwriter. We recently did a tribute to Bob and Al Hamilton at the Train Studio. We've had Frank Francis on this particular show. So basically, you talk about Bob being a vocalist, an instrumentalist, and a songwriter. Could you talk about those three things?
Yeah, I think what I was trying to say, I mean, Bob obviously does all of those things. He was primarily, in terms of his performance and in the studio, everybody knows him as a singer. He also played acoustic guitar, most famously on Redemption Song, and he also played rhythm guitar on stage as well, and in studio.
Could he actually play flute too?
You may know more about that than I do. I'm mostly aware of his rhythm guitar, but you might be correct there, Otis. So one of the points I tried to make in that presentation was that I thought that his strongest contribution, or the strongest contribution to him, to Bob Marley being an icon, was as a songwriter. And I argued that before he became famous, before he became internationally famous as a recording artist and as a stage performer, singing his songs around the world, that he, in fact, was a great songwriter. And the way that I proved that was to say that his work was covered, and this happened in the early 1970s, around the time when he just got signed to Island. During that time, he was covered by some really great luminaries, including Barbra Streisand, Eric Clapton, Taj Mahal, an African American pop singer, Johnny Nash. So, and I think during that time, which is around 1972 to 1974, he actually became then at that point a really important songwriter.
Speaking with Clive Walker, the author of Dubwise, Reasoning from the Reggae Underground, and one of the points you made was in terms of Bob Marley as a vocalist. At the end of his career, he was singing completely different from the beginning, because when I listen to early Bob Marley, all I hear is Bobby Lester of the Moonglows, from the phrasing and everything. I think I'm correct in saying that, because the Moonglows came out in the 50s, and I know that everybody that I know that tried to sing, including myself, if you had a group, you listen to the Moonglows, then Harvey and the Moonglows, but first it was Bobby Lester was the lead singer singing Sincerely, and I could hear Bob lick for lick doing Bobby Lester in the beginning, but at the end of his career, he was more Jamaican-centered. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Yeah, certainly, like a lot of singers of his generation, Bob Marley was clearly influenced by rhythm and blues, by African-American rhythm and blues. And yeah, I think this is well documented that a lot of artists in Jamaica were listening to radio stations out of Florida and out of New Orleans, you know, during the 50s and during the early 60s. In fact, the sound systems that people talk about in Jamaica, the mobile discotheques, as they've been described, were playing a lot of blues, a lot of R&B, and a lot of jazz before Jamaican popular music, you know, became more entrenched. And so, you know, there's definitely a huge influence there from you know, the R&B world. And I think, you know, during the scat era, the Wailers definitely had that R&B sound. And I believe that the Moonglows were a group that certainly that Marley listened to. You know, he's talked about being a big fan of Billy Stewart, Sitting in the Park. He talked, you know, clearly he was a huge fan of the Impressions and Curtis Mayfield. And, you know, One Love contains a line of People Get Ready. So, you know, definitely that influence was there. But I think, you know, as a Rastafari and as somebody who is also very much grounded in the African-Jamaican tradition, right, and the African-Jamaican hand-drum tradition, and in the tradition of a lot of the what they call African Christian religions, right? Mm-hmm. So that influence was also very powerful on him. And if you listen to, you know, if your listeners are familiar with Burning Spear and Joseph Hill of Culture, you know, that kind of vocal styling really drew a lot from indigenous Jamaican rhythms, right? And I think that's the direction that Bob Marley clearly moved into, certainly by the roots reggae phase. His voice has sounded a lot different than it did. It was a much more grittier voice, a much more hollowed-out kind of voice, and than the kind of more sweeter, smoother R&B stylings that he had earlier on.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. I'm on the line with Clive Walker, the author of Dubwise, Reasoning from the Reggae Underground. Now, Bob performed here in Toronto and went all around the world. I was fortunate enough to see him here and in Los Angeles, and I saw him when Peter Tosh took the stage with him. I think it was in Santa Barbara. How many times did you see Bob, and how did you evaluate his live performances? And I presume you saw him in Jamaica as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the most important time that I saw him was when I was in high school. And I said, so it's quite an interesting story, because we had, you know, I guess, what would be in North America the equivalent to grade 12, right? Across all the high schools in Kingston, in the capital of Jamaica, we had an association called the Fifth Form Association, or the Grade 12 Association. And we used to kind of host concerts, and sometimes we would get like sort of B-list or C-list type, you know, reggae singers that would come to these things, right? But there was a rumor flying around that we could actually get the Wailers, and that, you know, one of Rita Marley's cousins went to one of the high schools at the time, was part of the association, and, you know, we're all kind of doubters that this would ever happen. And they actually had to have it in a cinema, right, on a stage in a cinema called State Theater, because the crowd would have been so big. And, you know, I was able to see the Wailers. At the time, they weren't really backed up by Family Man and his brother at the time, who were called the Hippie Boys at the time. They were backed up by a band called the In Crowd. And, you know, they sang, I believe they sang Small Axe, and I believe they sang Sun Is Shining, because we're going back quite a few years now. We're going back to probably somewhere around the time of 1970. And, yeah, that was a real kind of it was a very special performance, because you're looking at, you know, a few hundred people in a cinema seeing the Wailers. This is maybe a full 2 years before they get signed to Island Records. And they were nice enough, even though they were huge stars in Jamaica at the time, they were nice enough to do a free concert for high school grade 12 people. And, you know, it was a transcendent performance. I mean, Bob Marley, you know, at that time, even at that time, was hugely charismatic. I mean, and I had seen him sort of on Jamaican television before that. And he was hugely captivating. I mean, I was maybe 16 at the time, and, you know, Bob Marley was a hero for us. He was a hero for teenagers, for those of us who were teenagers at the time. And he wasn't, you know, entirely mainstream at the time. He had some mainstream hits, but, you know, he was still kind of had one foot in the mainstream and one foot in the underground, so to speak. So, you know, there was still something really rebellious and, you know, and insidious about his persona, right? Not to mention the lyrics and the revolutionary lyrics that we love so much.
Now, at that time, it was Bob, Neville O'Reilly, Livingston, Bunny Wailer, Hubert Winston, McIntosh, Peter Tosh, what's the name, Walde Semi, yeah, let me get all my names right. And who else was in the Wailers at that particular time? Was it just the three of them, or was
it was just the three of them. It was just right. The three of them. And, you know, one of the things that I found, you know, another reason why it's a good thing you brought that out, because one of the things that really stood out to me, the three of them just came, right? They didn't bring any of the instruments or anything like that. The three of them just came as singers. Because we're looking now at the period now where a lot of these harmony trios, right, would just that. The Wailers started off as a harmony trio. There's no band or nothing. And a lot of the bands at the time, whether the Heptones or the Maytals or any of these groups, the Paragons, they all kind of were just a singing group. There was no kind of band element to them. But clearly, one of the things that a lot of people argue is that Peter was a musician of the band. And I remember when they're doing Sun Is Shining, there's a really distinctive keyboard vamp in Sun Is Shining, and the keyboardist for the band that was backing him up wasn't getting it right, and Peter kind of shifted him away. You know, when that vamp came up for the second time, Peter kind of shifted him off the keyboard and did the vamp, and everybody cheered because it actually came out much more accurate when Peter did it. And so Peter go ahead, Otis.
No, so that seemed like a scene out of the Five Heartbeats, but go ahead. The Five Heartbeats when they bumped the guy off the piano and they were messing up the song. You understand?
Yeah. So, you know, I think, you know, the three of them really had a certain persona about them. I mean, one thing I argue is that, you know, the Wailers were a supergroup, just like the Impressions, just like the Temptations, just like the Beatles. They were a supergroup. And so there's an idea, I think, with some people, a sentimental idea that, you know, they would have made better music if they stayed together. I don't necessarily buy into that. I think that the three of them separately really gave us some music that we wouldn't have gotten if they stayed together. I mean, we wouldn't have gotten Equal Rights, that you know, fantastic classic album by Peter Tosh. We wouldn't have gotten Black Heart Man, which is also a classic. And we certainly wouldn't have gotten the catalog of fabulous music that we get from Bob. And, you know, there's an interview that Peter does on right here in Toronto on City TV, where he talks about the fact that one of the reasons why he left the Wailers is that he didn't want to decorate Bob's music anymore. And I think that in the period before they signed with Island Records, essentially, Peter and Bunny were really backup singers. And I think he wanted to explore all the talent and all the creativity. Peter, I'm talking about now. He wanted to explore all that creativity that he had pent up in him. And of course, you know, he gave us a great catalog of music and some great live performances. And in fact, Peter, you know, as a reggae artist, is probably second only to Bob in terms of his international appeal.
Mm-hmm. in terms of Bob, let's move to the, you know, the internationalization of reggae and the internationalization of the music of Robert Nesta Marley. Could you talk about his impact on the African continent and his impact on black people in North America and in Europe?
Yeah, I think Bob definitely is somebody who's had a tremendous, I mean, there's this thing that people say about Bob that, you know, his popularity at one point in Africa, you know, rivaled Nelson Mandela, which I think is just one way of saying that he was very popular in throughout Africa. And he backed this up with traveling there several times. Obviously, you know, listeners must know that Ethiopia is really a central focus for Rastafari, which is what Bob Marley was. But Bob traveled to a variety of different countries in Africa, certainly on the West Coast, certainly Zimbabwe, where he performed at their independence celebrations. And as a result of that, there's a number of different reggae became a music that became part of the musical language of Africa. Alpha Blondé, I guess, is probably the easiest artist in Africa to mention in terms of clearly Alpha Blondé took a lot of his cues and his influence from Bob. And there's a variety of of different groups throughout Africa that, you know, we could mention. I mean, Sonny Okason's from Nigeria, Toure Koundé from Senegal. There's a number of different different artists. We could talk about the late Lucky Dube, who really, in a sense, was the Peter Tosh of South Africa. To kind of bring Peter into the argument a little bit. So in terms of Africa, I think that's part of the story there. I think in America, absolutely, Bob had a huge, huge influence. And, you know, I'm some of the artists, the R&B artists that I think he admired so much were definitely, enamored with the kind of talent that he had. Certainly, you know, Roberta Flack and Bob were friends. Stevie Wonder and Bob Marley. Stevie Wonder certainly did a tribute to Bob Marley on that album Master Blaster, which contains the tribute to Martin Luther King. He does Hotter Than July, which is where he talks about the popularity of Bob Marley and the popularity of reggae. So I think, you know, there's some definite, and I mean, I think, you know, that link with America is I think one of the things I've talked about is that there's a conversation going on, right? I mean, people talk about the fact that it's like, as if it's a one-way street, that, you know, the influence is one way from America only. But I think it's a two-way street. And you can see that in terms of, you know, the Staple Singers, exactly. Taking the opening bars of I'll Take You There to open, of the Liquidator, which is a Jamaican instrumental, taking the opening bars of that for I'll Take You There. I mean, you can see that conversation that's going on between, Jamaica and America, dating back to the late 60s, dating back to the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s. You know, Aretha Franklin having a song on her album, Young, Gifted, and Black, called Rocksteady, right? And even though it was a very funky song, I think that came from a trip that Aretha made to Jamaica. There's a story that a good friend of mine, Jamaican musicologist Dermot Hussey, tells about Miles Davis, that when he tried to talk to Miles when Miles was in Ocho Rios in Jamaica, and for some reason they didn't get a chance to talk, but he talked to the Miles's girlfriend, and she was saying that the entire summer of 1975, Miles was locked in a room listening to Natty Dread album over and over again. And eventually Miles actually does do some really, really interesting fusions of jazz and reggae. So, yeah, I mean, I think that kind of answers, you know, that particular question.
Someone made the statement that Miles had made a statement that Family Man knew how to take care of the family or something to that effect.
That's correct. That's part of the really, same story.
He was really influenced by Family Man Austin. Family Man
That's
Barrett,
correct.
Pardon. Austin,
right.
Austin Barrett. Now, in terms of Bob as a, when he went to Europe to work with Johnny Nash and he had the breakout, how did, you know, could you talk about, when he went to Sweden and what took place with Bob, Johnny Nash, and I think the brother out of
Arthur, yeah.
Arthur, but the other, the money man.
Arthur Jenkins. Danny Sims.
Danny Sims, yeah. Could you talk about that,
yeah.
that link?
Yeah, I mean, I think what happened was, I mean, and to kind of, you know, give the briefest answer to that question, I think what happened is that Johnny Nash was more, you know, to give the briefest and kindest answer to that question, I think that Johnny was interested more in Bob Marley's writing skills. And I think the promise was between, you know, because, you know, all three of those guys, Johnny Nash, Arthur Jenkins, and Danny Sims, had a company they called JAD, which is the initials of their names. And I think the idea was to sign the Wailers to that label and to then promote the Wailers, right, as a singing group and as a recording group. And that didn't seem to come off. What really clearly happened when they went to Europe, when they took Bob to Europe in particular, was that he became more or less a songwriter for Johnny Nash. And that essentially is reflected in the album. I can see clearly now where Bob has three songs on that album, all three of which became very, very popular. I think two of them may have become singles, and one of them was very popular. So I think that, you know, things kind of soured, because I think Bob didn't just want to be a songwriter. I think he wanted to be a recording artist. I think they had one. They actually did record a song with him, Reggae on Broadway, which, you know, did, I think they recorded an entire album, but Reggae on Broadway was the one that was released at that time. And, you know, it was played on mainstream radio and so on. So they did fulfill part of the promise. But really, the focus seemed to be more on Johnny Nash and his career, which had just kind of blown up again. And so, you know, things really didn't work out. And Bob was a little bit despondent. And that, you know, it's at that point that he, well, all three of the Wailers are there in Europe. And they, Bob ends up seeking and getting a meeting with Chris Blackwell. And then Chris Blackwell, who essentially was looking for an important reggae act, because Jimmy Cliff had left him and gone over to, I think, Polygram, right? Jimmy Cliff, who had just starred in The Holiday Come, was kind of the biggest thing in reggae at the time. He was the biggest international star in reggae. You know, may have felt that maybe Ireland hadn't treated him as well and decided to leave and go to an American label. Mm-hmm. So now Chris Blackwell, you know, when Bob walks into Chris Blackwell's office, this is a major opportunity, because he thought that the time was right now to push reggae. And so, you know, the rest is history. I mean, Chris Blackwell signs the Wailers and actually has to pay money to Danny Sims to get him out of that contract.
Okay, now I'm speaking with Clive Walker, author of a book called Double Wire's Reasoning from the Reggae Underground. And I remember reading that Bob went to, I think it was Wilmington, Delaware. That's where I think Clifford Brown was out of Wilmington, Delaware. But the significance of him being in Wilmington, Delaware was that he was, he worked, I think, for Chrysler, and I understand he was a member of the UAW. And I think he did that song Night Shift, which was about working. He was a union man as well as a worker. Could you talk about that period?
Yeah, I mean, you know, definitely he worked in a factory. I mean, he was really, I mean, to use a term, a Marxist term, he was really part of the industrial proletariat. You know, he really, adding to that now, talking about him, you know, as actually being part of the union and so on. I think this definitely, that period in the States, I think he was already politicized, you know, as a Rastafari coming out of Jamaica, and understanding, you know, nationalist politics and black power politics. But I think certainly this brought, added a new dimension to his understanding now, by being involved as a factory worker in the American heartland, and basically having to make a living. And I think one of the things about that period also is the fact that it really was, in some ways, a diversion from what his real, you know, calling was, which was to be a singer-songwriter and band leader. And I think in the end, he decided to go back to Jamaica, to leave, which is almost, unheard of. I mean, most immigrants don't do that. They don't decide to go back to the poverty of the country where they come from, right? Maybe if you're a middle class Jamaican, you can go back. But for somebody coming from Trenchtown, this is almost unheard of. I mean, he went back, really, to poverty in a way, right? Because he wanted to continue his career as a singer. And the group, the Wailers, actually, were kind of put on hold because Bonnie and Peter really didn't continue the group after Bob left. And so when Bob, I think it was some like 18 months he spent in the States, that when he went back, it rekindled the Wailers again. And, you know, I mean, I guess we could say, you know, what would have happened if Bob had stayed in the factory and had worked there, and took the typical route of the immigrant. But I think, you know, to really answer the essence of your question, I think it definitely expanded his consciousness in terms of, go ahead.
I said, but don't you feel that he actually went back because he didn't want to go to Vietnam? I think that has, that's partially, he went back because he was drafted, I understand, and he refused to go and he came back home. That was a key factor, not wanting to, fight for the U.S. government. I mean, I don't think he saw himself as fighting he wasn't. Well, a lot of immigrants did do that in order to get their green cards and so forth. But
he—that's correct.
I won't mention any names, but there's a guy that worked very closely with Peter Tosh, and he actually fought in Vietnam and came back, and you know he became. A lot of people came back, and going to Vietnam, came back at different people and injected themselves into the black liberation struggle. But we have 3 minutes left. I wanted you to talk about your book, how the book is doing, and how people can get a copy of Dubwise Reasoning from the Reggae Underground.
Yeah, I think the book is doing reasonably well. I mean, it's gotten as far as Australia, which is something I never dreamed that would happen. I mean, I figured the biggest markets for it would be in Europe and in North America and obviously in the Caribbean. I'm happy with the fact that it's being used in courses at various universities in all of those countries that I mentioned. And, the book, you can get the book on Amazon. I think that's probably the easiest and place to get it. Dubwise Reasoning from the Reggae Underground, man. I think it's a good read. I think it gives readers a glimpse of a side of the music that you probably haven't heard of.
Now we have captured you live and direct at the Train Studio, and that's going to go up on YouTube with your permission as soon as we get a few things straight, so I guess people can look forward to seeing
absolutely
a presentation that you made on Robert Nestor Marley and his contribution to, I don't like the term world music, his contribution to the world of music.
I actually like that term. I like your term better.
Yeah, because I don't. World music is, you know, opera comes out of a culture and reggae comes out of a culture, but when it comes to African people's culture, somehow we have to take a back seat, you know, and it becomes everybody's music, but, you know, other people's music is belongs to them, but our music is everybody's music, which our music has influenced everybody as far as we know that. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, but I just want to thank you for having me on your show. I think it's always a pleasure talking to you, Otis, and always a pleasure sharing, you know, sharing and conversing with you. I mean, you know, you definitely are somebody with a real depth of knowledge, and yeah, so it's been a pleasure.
Now, this will be archived so people can listen to this forever and a day, so... You know, I guess we'll this should be up maybe a half an hour after we finish the show. So, let everybody know that they can go to Uhuru Radio and listen to your interview.
Absolutely, absolutely, we'll do that, man. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and we have been speaking with Clive Walker, the author of Dubwise Reasoning from the Reggae Underground, and we're gonna go to some music. We're going to Unite Africa with Robert Nestor Marley and the Wailers. You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. And it's not so cold in the Great White North today, but we were listening to Bob Marley and the Wailers, and they did a song called Africa Unite. And we just had a long interview with Clive Walker off of a great book, Dubwise, which I suggest you go out and pick up. But now we wanted to play something. This is African Liberation Month, Black History Month, which began in 1926 as Negro History Week. And Ziggy Marley and the Melody Makers talk about Black My Story.
Black my story. 'Cause if you come from Clarendon, and if you come from Portland, and if you come from Westmoreland, you're an African. So don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African. No mind your nationality, I've got the identity of an African. But if you come from Trinidad, and if you come from So don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African. No mind your complexion, there is no rejection, you're an African. 'Cause if your complexion high, 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 your complexion low, and if your complexion in between, so don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African. No mind denomination, that is only segregation, you're an African. 'Cause if you go to the Catholic, and if you go to the Methodist, and if you go to the Church of God, so don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African. No mind your nationality, I've got the identity of an African. 'Cause if you come from Brixton, and if you come from Eastgate, and if you come
you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We were listening to the music of Walde Semayat, Peter Tosh, Hubert Winston McIntosh was his name at birth, and he gave us a song called African, and we also heard from Ziggy Marley and the Melody Makers, and they did Africa Unite, and we're getting ready to take you to Dreamland with Bunny Wailer, another one of the Wailers, Neville O'Reilly Livingston, and then we're going to listen to Marcia Griffith do the same song, and it's called Dreamland.
There's a land that I've heard about so far across the sea. There's a land that I have heard about so far across the sea. To have you on my dreamland would be like my
on that dreamland and hell. So much fun.
That was Marcia Griffiths and Bunny Wheeler doing a song called Dreamland. This is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. This is African Liberation Month. It began in 1926 as a Negro History Week, and as the time went by, it became Black History months, and then the imperialists got a hold of it, and we would see the great kings and queens of Africa brought to you by Burger King, and the imperialists got in there, and they co-opted Black History Month. It became a month, and it was no longer a week. And then people begin to question, what is the purpose of history? And some people said that, while we definitely should not take anything away from the scientists, even George Washington Carver and the peanut. Malcolm used to make a lot of fun of George Washington Carver and how he made Henry Ford rich. But not to belittle any of our people that made contributions, but the most important factor of any people's existence is their liberation. So some people said instead of Black history, just like we changed it from Negro to Black and now African, and we went from a week to a month, we should go from history to liberation, since that's what we should be about, and this liberation month should include the history of all African people, all working class African people, the workers and peasants of Africa, the so-called New World, and Africans are in Europe, and Africans are in the South Pacific, and we should study the history of our liberation movements, and we should know about people like Amilcar Cabral and Fannie Lou Hamer. We should know about Patrice Lumumba. We should know about Kwame Nkrumah, Queen Nzinga. We should know about Peter Tosh and Gil Scott-Heron and the Mighty Sparrow, Calypso Rose. And I'm just mentioning all those names. I should mention that Clevel James of the Limers, he's listening to us. And I'd like to thank Keisha Bolden for teching today's show. And we will be Black, I guess, in 2 weeks. And as I say all the time, we will see you in the whirlwind. And we're going to leave you with the music of Judy Mowat, one of the I3s, and she's going to give us a Robert Nesta Marley composition called Concrete Jungle. And we will, once again, as Marcus Mosiah Garvey would say, we will see you in the whirlwind.
people around the world.
Uhuru. We live in a world that is constructed of the theft of the resources, both material and human, of African and other people as a consequence of its existence. It's stealing black labor, black bodies, black territory, of the rape of Asia, Latin America, etc. It's a rotten, foul...
individualist, adventurist, people who engage in lumping type criminal behavior that they want to give some kind of revolutionary cloak to, you know, that could endanger the party, our reputation among the masses of the people and everything else. So, I mean, there are a lot of creatures who've come through this process, you know, who now have this, you know, who in most instances we actually brought to political life. They got their theory, they got their politics from us. Some of them used to say, well, you know, I just hate, you know, we love O'Malley Shatella, right? But we just don't like the party. Well, I am the party. This is my party. I'm a part of this party. You can't separate me from the party with some jive time flattery, you know, some, you know, Negro who's been around for 30 seconds, 30 minutes, 2 years, 2 months, and they're going to love me but hate the party. You know, this is my party. You can't flatter me into a separation from the African People's Socialist Party. Are you crazy? You know, and so, you know, we see a lot of that kind of stuff, and we say revisionism is that they want to take African internationalism, sometimes even by another name. Reality is, when we go through African internationalism, that's one of the reasons this whole 103-page document was so important. To elaborate on where we've been, you know, even how, you know, people know about reparations, but they don't know the role we played in reparations. And to me, to sit up in a meeting and have somebody introduced as the father of modern reparations, I'm sitting there and he couldn't look at me when they introduced him like that. He's the one who in 1989, we existed for 7 years. He's the one who stood up in the meeting when we were trying to build the tribunal in Anro and stormed out because we criticized their politics. He wouldn't even participate. He sent a message saying that he was concerned that if we got reparations, the white people was going to get the money. He sent a message because we had a tribunal that had Africans sitting on the tribunal from different places in the African world to make a judgment as to whether the United States was guilty of the various crimes that we, according to international law. He sends a message saying that he don't think the Africans from the continent shouldn't be up there because they owe us reparations too for selling us into slavery. And so now I'm sitting there, this is the same Negro who was won over to participating in some kind of reparations organization by Ronald Wilson Reagan. Reagan gave the Japanese a pitch that they called reparations, and then they had an epiphany and decided to build this organization that they've, I'm not going to tell you what it is, they decided to build this organization around reparations. And then we went to the meeting, here we are coming from the organization that built reparations, went to the meeting, and the guy says, well, what should we call it? So, well, maybe we should call it, I was thinking we should call it Reparations Now. I don't know where our idea came from, but I think we should call it Reparations Now. And Comrade Secretary General Gaida threw the book on the table that had all of the transcripts and stuff from the first reparations tribunal. She said, this is where you got it from. The name was reparations. You understand? We did that. You know, and there's a whole history when the whole movement had been debilitated, wiped out, literally. And Negroes who call themselves revolutionaries and black nationalists, they were existing, you know, like subterraneously, you know, underground, etc., afraid to come up. We were selling newspapers, and never forget, in Oakland, California, this person walks up and says, hey, you can't do that out here in public. If you do that, the police is going to do this. We're the ones who raised them all of them up. Every one of them, except, and I'm not even going to talk about all of it, you know, because, you know, people should be allowed to maintain an element of dignity, and we're not, it's not an assault on that, you know, it's not an assault.